Well, Charles, the one thing you know about Charles is that he is a great character. We've been friends for a few years, and he's a wonderful poet. And what I love about Charles is that he has a real sensitivity for song. And for me, as a composer, that's been an absolute joy. So we've been collaborating now for about 3 or 4 years.
Yes.
And for me, as a composer, it's wonderful to be able to collaborate with someone else and to share the vision of the piece. And so I think it's very nice that you've come here, Charles, and you can introduce these pieces that we're going to do tonight.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
So, I'm going to kind of frame 5 Days That Changed the World, the piece we're going to hear tonight. I'm going to frame that in a bit of contentious talk about poetry and song anyway. Because people quite often ask me, when they hear that I'm working with Bob, they kind of go, oh, and how is that? And what happens? And do the words come last? And does Bob say to you, right, well, there's the tune, and now you've got to put some words to it, and that kind of thing. So I thought I'd say a few outrageous things about that. So let's do the naughty negative stuff first. Because in one sense, poetry and music might, if you're not working with Bob, they might be in conflict, they might be in competition. So for example, what you have to remember is that, you know, saying is not singing. We know that. You know, saying is not singing. And therefore, if we're not careful, the verbal music of the poem, because words have their own music built into them, that music might be lost and absorbed when the poem is set to music. That words are, as it were, overgrown with notes, in one sense. And therefore, they might lose all sense and meaning. And in a way, your poem might be damaged, funnily enough, by being set to music. I'm not talking about Bob here. So what happens is that the song, as it were, the structure of the song replaces the intricate verbal structure of the poem. That you might, for example, come on in, you've missed nothing, I've only been nattering. You might be caught up in the surface enjoyment of the music, but you will perhaps not be challenged to reflect and contemplate on the meaning of those words, or, of course, to read them again, because you're just going to hear that song once. Instead, you're invited, as it were, to be passive and to enjoy that musical activity. The other thing that happens when you have a poem set to music is that stanzas and line breaks are lost, as it were. Now, hymns we know, because they rhyme, they're still, you know, you might still see. But if you're not careful, when you're setting, what happens is those lines and line breaks and stanza breaks, they're all kind of elongated and stretched out. And you are not sure as a singer sometimes, or certainly as a listener, where the poet has put the line break or the stanza break in. So they're lost, they're absorbed, they're kind of elongated, mangled even, we might say. There's the lost shape of poetic integrity in, you know, a bad setting of a poem, perhaps. And therefore, in the worst kind of, you know, if the composer wants to dominate the words, meaning is replaced with sound. And therefore, verbal intensity becomes musical immediacy. Come on in, you've not. I'm just coming to the end of the first bit.
Thank you.
So, meaning is replaced with sound if you're not careful. Verbal intensity becomes musical immediacy. The composer's voice masks the poet's authentic utterance with egotistical display. Now that's in the worst sense of setting words. In other words, if you're not careful, the music can dominate completely. And the words, in a sense, take a back seat. So that's the dark side of words and music, the sense that they're, in one way, they might be in competition. However, I would like to suggest that in a kind of a balance, what actually happens is that words and music might be in a companionable relationship rather than a competitive relationship. And there are various things that poems and songs do share. So, for example, structure. The architecture of words and notes is a shared form. Now, it's different, of course. Word music is not you know, sung music, but there is a shared structure that the musical matrix is, as it were, laid over the verbal one. Also rhythm. Poems and songs depend on the medium of time, of course, they have a set length. So although there is the elongation of sounds and the stratification of words, in other words, that, you know, you have a line from the poem sung at different periods, different parts of the choir might be singing the same line, and therefore there's a what I'm calling stratification of words. But that rhythm is part of the way that the poet speaks to the composer, actually. The stanzas and line breaks are still, in a sense, there in the song, because songs and poems work with the breath. Punctuation, by the way, is about controlling the reader's breath, actually. Telling someone when to go. So in a slightly creepy way, you're controlling someone's breath. Because, of course, the poem is really like a musical score. The poem is actually meant to be read out loud. Poetry, although we forget this, is really a verbal art form. The slight difficulty with that is that we've got very used to reading, we've forgotten to read poetry out loud, and we've gotten how to do that. And many poets, hopefully I'm not one of those, but many poets don't always read their poems terribly well, and that can be a bit off-putting, frankly.
Anyway,
a meaning is the most important thing, of course, because both forms, song and poem, seek to enhance our experience of everyday life. They want to refresh our lives through powerful and affecting utterances that we share. The poem wants to communicate with you, doesn't it? It wants to, in a little way, change your life or change your perception. Or you read the poem and you think to yourself, oh my word, that's really good, that's exactly right, I couldn't quite have put it that way. Or, do you know, I've never quite seen it that way before, but that's spot on, that's just right. So there's that idea of sharing in writing and in singing. So let me just now say something about 5 days that changed the world, and how nice it is to be able to work with Bob, and also, you know, how nice it is to be commissioned, and how nice it is to be here, and looking forward to hearing them. So when I came to write 5 days that changed the world, and I wanted to write about something positive that human beings have done, for a change to some extent, but I wanted to write about something positive. What I wanted to give Bob was, and the words, with Bob and I, the words always come first. Bob says, write me the words first. And then, of course, he mangles them and ruins them by all that dreadful music gets in the way. Anyway, so I wanted to give Bob a series of opportunities. And the way that I do that is I am consciously thinking of writing words that are going to be sung, which is very different from when I come to write a poem. And of course, when I'm being commissioned, I am, as it were, self-consciously writing something that is going to be sung. And a commission is a very different thing from a poem that might come to you naturally. So you try and put yourself in the same zone, as it were. You try and tune in to your poetic nature. But in the first one, the invention of printing, I'll say a little bit about this. Well, the invention of printing, of course, you know, revolutionised education partly, really. Most of us in this room, you know how to read and how to write through the invention of printing. And if we hadn't had that, we probably would all be still ignorant peasants, you know, and everyone would still be speaking Latin, perhaps. So one of the things I thought about was The Quick Brown Fox Jumps Over the Lazy Dog, which, you know, when you were learning how to type in the olden days, when we had them typewriters and that, when you were learning to do that, if you typed The Quick Brown Fox Jumps Over the Lazy Dog, you would use every key on the typewriter once. So I was thinking about type. I was thinking about set type and movable type and how the printers would get that movable and arrange it on what was called a form, by the way. And when I worked for a printers years ago, there was still one little bit of the printers where they had all the font trays and they could still lay things up by hand. And of course, it was very soon, wasn't very long before, all the people were made redundant, all that skill was lost, and we moved over to the good old word processor. It looks like you're writing a letter. Do you remember that wonderful paper clip that used to appear? It looks like you're writing a letter. No, I'm not writing a letter. Go right anyway. So the chorus was The Quick Brown Fox. And one of the things I did for Bob was I gave him rhythm. So something you can use out of poetry is rhythm. The quick brown fox, quick brown fox, the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. I saw them walking like footprints in the snow. Saw them walking into houses all over the world. Opened the door of the eye and let them in. I saw each letter. Saw each letter like a person. Z was lonely and E was everyone's friend. I watched them gather together into words. I knew if I took the letters one by one, knew if I held them tight in 42 lines, they could speak to everyone everywhere. In the beginning, there were footprints over the page. The footprints of a fox who jumps into your eye and over the lazy dog. So what I'm doing is now, I'm giving you a kind of verbal performance of a text I wrote to be sung. So I don't usually read poetry this way, by the way, but I'm just giving you that kind of rhythmic flavour that I heard when I was writing it, that Bob obviously ignored completely, but that I heard this rhythm when I was writing it. Just a couple of things. I wrote each one as what we call the dramatic monologue. So I wrote it in the voice of Gutenberg. So the first one was written for Gutenberg. And 42 lines, one of the most famous things he did, of course, was, you know, the Bible. And the Bible was in this 42-line chunks, because that's how many lines he could get on the form. So he wrote this rather famous 42-line Bible. Of course, promulgating that religious knowledge changed people's lives very fundamentally. Because it was as well, you were getting access, as an ordinary person, you were getting access to divine knowledge, which until then had been, you know, belonged to the priests, if you see what I mean. So that was a very profound kind of movement. Z, of course, was lonely because there aren't many Zs, but E is the most common letter in the alphabet. So E was everyone's friend. In the abolition of slavery, shame I can't show you this, but in the abolition of slavery, which is the second piece I wrote, there's a kind of little structure in the stanzas so that they have a shape, and you'll hear this shape reflected in repetition. So one of the other things that poetry shares with music is, of course, repetition. Poetry uses repetition and uses variation on repetition, and you'll hear me doing that here. Sometimes a piece of paper, a piece of white paper, can set a person free. Just a few words. A few words written in black ink on white paper can set a nation free. Sometimes one person, one good person, can set a nation free. Just a few words. A few words written on the open page of the human heart can set a people free. Give me the good words. Make me the right person. Give me a piece of paper to set me free. Pure words written on my open heart. Just a few words can set me free. I quite like that one. Okay, well then, we came on to the first powered flight, which was all kinds of fun, because it meant I had to do some research into the Wright brothers, you know. And they turned out to be, I mean, the Wright brothers, it's quite incredible, you know. It's like, you know, there's the Wright brothers, and they have these kind of bicycles, you know. That's the business. And one of them kind of go, well, perhaps we, you know, if we sorted the bikes out, we kind of win, and maybe we could. I mean, the idea of flight came from a conception, didn't it? It came from an idea, it came from a thought. You know, they had a bright idea, oh, maybe, and we ran down, and by the way, what they built was an absolute nightmare, kept falling to bits, and had to build it again, and I mean, they had the rudder almost at the front instead of at the back. So, controlling the flyer, as they called it, controlling it was incredibly difficult. And they kind of, they lay on it. They lay prostrate, on this damn thing. And sometimes it didn't quite work. And of course, the first accident, the first person to be killed in a kind of aeronautical accident was somebody who, the flyer went off course, and one of the people who helped them was sadly killed. So, but the thing that got me about this story was persistence. I rather liked that, this kind of doggedness. First powered flight. A thought can learn to fly if you give it wings. I said to Orville, perhaps, maybe, if, perhaps, we might possibly try. And we did. And it was difficult. Below us, the ground was green and heavy with failure, ready to break our fall. But a thought will fly sometimes if you give it wings. I said to Wilbur, why not? Most everything that could went wrong before. But it pulled us up in the end. We said to each other, let's toss for who goes first. And we did. And it was glorious. We carried it back to the top of Killdevil Hill. How many times? I forget. But we did. And it was. And it is. And there you have it. Sometimes a dream will fly. So then we went on to the discovery of penicillin, which was quite light, because I knew something about that from being at school, do you know what I mean? And something must have gone in when I was very young about how important the penicillin and that kind of thing. And I vaguely remember this, but then, again, I did a bit of research, a bit of reading around, and the story is just so fantastic, that he kind of goes away on holiday and then comes back. And no one's done the washing up in the laboratory. All these petri dishes, full of culture. Rather like the arts. Anyway, there's petri dish full of cultures, and it's like he's washing them up. I'm back from a bloody holiday. First thing I know, Monday morning. And one of them are going, that's a bit funny. I'll just put that to what I'll do the rest, I'll come back to that one later. And there it was, that something that can heal us is actually an accident, and it was mouldy. Do you know what I mean? Mould? I mean, if we'd seen a bit of mould, we'd go, oh dear, I don't like that. Scrape the mould off that bit of cheese and, give it to the cat. So, I love that. I love that idea of things discovering you, in a way. And of course, all these texts, if I'm honest, are in a sense metaphors for artistic creation as well. They are, of course, deeply personal texts and can be read that way. But I just use them all as metaphors for creativity. Because who wants to hear about me and my creativity? Except you, of course, who you've come today, you must be mad. So, discovery of penicillin. Green blue. It was green blue. I happened upon it. Stumbled across it. It wasn't supposed to be there, but there it was. Sometimes you find what you're looking for where you never thought it would be. Thrown away. It was nearly thrown away. I cluttered the dishes, washed the pots. I thought there was something wrong, but it turned out right. Sometimes where you never thought it would be, there's what you've been looking for all along. Holiday. Just back from holiday. It was meant to be. Serendipity. What went wrong had gone as light as rain. Sometimes what you're looking for will find you. Sometimes what seems wrong was right all along. Blue green. It was blue green. I hope you find what you're looking for. Hope what you're looking for finds you. You can come in, you don't have to stand there in the corridor waiting. I'm going on for, have they not said it goes on for another 6 hours? Did you bring a packed lunch?
Yeah, right, so.
So then the last of the 5 days that changed the world was the First Man in Space. And again, I quite liked First Man in Space because I remembered that, you know. I remembered that. And I was pretty excited. And again, you know, it was lovely being the chance to revisit all these stories. And that they thought, of course, they, first of all, you know, Yuri Gagarin only got to get in there because somebody else had a bit of a cold, you know, it wasn't supposed to be him. And then, they, I mean, the truth is, let's be honest, they thought he was going to die, you know, and there was a lot of goodbye to the wife before he, you know, I mean, they thought he was going to die. Because, what you know, we are so much more sophisticated technologically, in theory, now. But when you go back to, you know, what the Russians did, with a bit of sort of baking soda, you know, and a bit of bleach, and put the two together and stand well back and light the blue touch paper. When you think of how that technology, you know, how groundbreaking it was, no one had done it before. And when you think you have to fly at 7 miles a second to escape, you know, Earth's gravity, that's how fast you have to go, by the way, 7 miles a second. Otherwise, what happens is this. And your rocket comes on. We've seen that too, you know. And when, if you've ever seen those pictures of rockets, they kind of go. And how expensive that is. So first of all, they thought he'd die, and then they thought he'd go mad. I mean, they had done this, and you know, they sent that dog Laika. If you remember, dear old Laika into space. But they thought if he didn't die, it would probably, you know, it'd be such a strange experience. Being so far away from home, you know, from Earth, that it actually, it would do something, and he'd go, isn't this a great word? Doolally. Yeah, my mum used to say that. So, and of course, in a way, he did. Everyone who goes into space, you know, it does something to them. Of course, the best way to save the planet, I mean, if we actually want to save the planet, if we could all get sent into space for a minute or two, and look at the Earth and see how small it was, we'd think, oh crikey, that's a closed system. We'd better look after it. Instead of pouring poison into it and thinking, well, we'll put a bit of poison in and it'll come out in China, it doesn't matter. We'd realise that the Earth is a closed system and we'd perhaps take better care of it. And many people who've been into space actually become kind of profoundly concerned about conservation issues and ecology and that kind of thing because it really affects you. And of course, what could be better in a way than being in space and looking at the planet? I mean, because it's gorgeous in space. You know, when you see those pictures, oh, you've seen that Earthrise picture from the moon, you know, and you kind of think, oh, isn't that heaven, you know? Anyway. And when he landed, it was wonderful, when he landed, there was this lady, you know, working in the potato field, and he kind of plonked down on this parachute. So he came out with all his kit, you know, and she's working away at the potato. She says, oh, she says, have you come from outer space? Because she thought he was an alien. And actually, of course, the answer was, well, yes, I have. And guess what? And a lot of the words I've taken here are things that Yuri Gagarin said, because he didn't say them in English. But, you know, I saw how beautiful our planet is. 17,000 miles an hour. They thought I might go mad, but I saw the face of God. The son of a carpenter circling round the earth. I saw how beautiful our planet is. April 12th, 1961. Stars are the alphabet of God. 108 minutes. Can it be that you have come from outer space? Well, yes, and I've seen something beautiful. Keep this beauty safe and let it grow. Stars are the smile of God. His face was the earth looking back. 520 people have seen how beautiful it is. 520 people, the number of people who've been to space. Of course, that number will change and be out of date, but you know, it's not very many actually when you think how many millions of us there are and how profoundly that's affected. But of course, you've got to be in pretty good shape to get into space, and so far nobody's invited me. So, in conclusion then, you know, I don't know about you, I always used to end my essays, you know, in conclusion then we may see that, you know. Well, songs bring inert poems to life. That's a good thing they do.
because the poems, you know, are locked away in those books, and if you don't take the book off the shelf and you don't open the book, you know, the poem is dead in a sense. It's inert. It's waiting for you, readers. You know, my poetry, hint, is waiting for you. Go to my website. I've got a new book out, and it's terribly good. Anyway, solitary reading of text. You, on your own, with a poem, not getting it. Do you know what I mean? You sit there and you go, oh, God, I don't get this. Now, what's he on about? John Donne, I'm not. So, solitary reading of a text becomes communal singing of a shared school. And that's why choral singing is just so marvellous. For me, as a solitary writer, seeing my words shared, you know, I mean, let's be honest, when I hear my words, something like that really does things for me. I really kind of, I well up, you know, I well up with tears about the terrible mess that Bob's made in my picture. The poet seeks to generate excellence in the composer. My job is to bring the best out of him. That's my job, and it's not easy. But somehow, I have to drag, you know, beauty out of Bob. Actually, Bob has a very beautiful soul. That's where the music comes from. I don't know where, but he does. And I'm very fortunate because, of course, Bob's music is music, you know, you can listen to it, can't you? And I rather like that kind of music personally, being a little bit traditional myself. But my job is to bring out excellence in him. By the way, just while I'm on my feet, as it were, well, with the students, you know, I'm talking, every now and then I go into Guru Bennett mode when I'm talking about relationships. Marriage, you know, what a marriage is for is your job is to bring out excellence in the other person. That's your job. And their job is to bring out excellence in you. And if you devote yourself to bringing out excellence in them, and they devote themselves to bringing out excellence in you, you'll have a really good marriage. Just thought I'd throw that in. That's free. And funny enough, through the poem's submission to music, as it were, meaning is grown and expanded. So Bob expands the meaning of my work through his music. And in fact, let's be honest, my words reach a lot more people. A lot more people have heard Bob's songs than have read my book of poems. Shame. And and what I get and what we're interested in is, as it were, the beauty of revelation, of revealing some kind of profound truth in a way. Now, we don't want to get too heavy about that, but that's actually what we're interested in. You know, what is art about? Art is about giving meaning to our lives and giving them a sense of purpose and changing them in some way and giving us a profound feeling in our hearts. You know, that's what we want from the arts, as I said. We want to go, wow. That's what we want, a bit of wow, you know. And tonight, you'll have a bit of wow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.